The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
You might remember from just a couple of weeks ago, that is a couple episodes ago, that Terry and I had a chance to go to this meeting right here in town with respect to the SOGI curriculum that's being implemented across BC and Alberta. And you may remember that we were talking about one of the presenters, the first one. His name is Paul Dirks, and we were telling you about how we were so riveted. Well, we thought it would be really, really helpful to actually invite him here. And he actually is here in person, so we get to see him up close and personal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. It's a great opportunity.
So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I am a husband of Rachel, and we have five children. So we have a busy household. 13 is my oldest. She's my only daughter. And then we have four boys, and four of them are in the public school system. So, of course, that plays into the whole SOGI curriculum and my own work. I've been a pastor at New West Community Church for 8 years. We have a beautiful multi-ethnic body. We're not a huge church, but we have incredible unity right across so many people groups, and just it's such a great privilege to serve our local church in that way.
You just mentioned the SOGI curriculum. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? What is this for our listeners who may not be familiar with it?
SOGI stands for Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. This is how I got involved in this whole area, is that our local school district, School District 40 in New Westminster, was implementing their new sexual orientation and gender identity policy. So it's all around, same-sex behavior, same-sex attraction, same-sex identity amongst adolescents, as well as gender identity, which really is associated with transgender, people that are transitioning from who are born as boys or girls or transitioning to the other gender. You know, how do we deal with this in schools? How do we support individuals? And yet we're entering into an area where we're talking about, it's very clear, we're talking about sexuality. You know, how do we address those things? You know, different people from different worldviews, backgrounds, religions will have greatly varying perspectives on sexuality. And, it's my view that if not all, the great proportion of that kind of teaching needs to happen in homes and not in school systems. So, these are some of the questions that have come up and in our school systems.
Is this curriculum the reason you started researching all of the homosexuality and transgenderism issues, or did this start way before?
You know, it's interesting because this is what got me involved in this whole area about 3 years ago. I was involved on the Parent Advisory Council of our elementary school, and the school district was looking for information from parents. They're looking for feedback on the policy. And as a Christian, as a father, and as a pastor, I thought, well, they're looking for feedback. I better give that. I need to enter into this, even if my views are not going to be, well liked necessarily in the school system or by secularists. And so that is really why I started doing the research. I knew I'm a presuppositionalist, so I believe what I believe on account of the Word of God. And yet I also believe, and again, because I'm a presuppositionalist, that truth will bear out necessarily in other areas, in other fields. And so I don't have to fear, for instance, looking at the peer-reviewed medical research, because I know that, whether fully or not, it will evidence the truths about who we are, how God has created us, the realities of the fall of man into sin, and all these things that we see in Scripture that it bears out in life. No one knows that better than you guys, doing apologetics all the time.
It is interesting, by the way, when you read the research that's coming out In fact, I was just reading a recent article from Sweden. I don't know if you've come across this, where there's a school in Sweden where gender is basically banned. You can't use any sort of gender references or pronouns or whatnot. In fact, they have a gender neutral pronoun that they use, and they go out of their way to avoid gender. But what was interesting in the article is that even in some place like Sweden, the research is still quite split. And there's a lot of people that, you know, think that this is absolutely ridiculous what the school is doing. I find that fascinating. You would think that if the school saw, that there was overwhelming support for this, that they would, you know, head down that path. But that's not the case.
Yeah.
It's still quite contentious.
And, you know, it's interesting that we've arrived at the place we have, that there is, especially around transgender kind of related issues, gender identity issues, that the science is, you know, amongst sex researchers, you know, it's really mixed. It's really varied. It's exceptionally contentious. There are an enormous amount of sex researchers that do not adhere to, you know, what we might call the prevailing trans dogma in the mainstream media. There are a tremendous amount of researchers that are, who have actually come out very recently and saying that what we're seeing with the incredible increase of gender dysphoria in children and adolescents represents social contagion. People like Ray Blanchard, Michael Bailey, so many others. So it's a significant group, and it's so interesting to hear and to experience, you know, in some cases very personally, how the culture and the mass media has gone so far, far ahead, you know, of the literature, far ahead of contentious issues that we're seeing being worked out still in the medical field.
And just even the concern of what will be the societal impacts of implementing these ideas? What effect is this going to have on our children?
Yeah.
And really, it's just totally up in the air.
Yeah, it is. And you know, from as a Christian, one of the things that I think is among the saddest pieces of all of this is that we're no longer willing to tell a girl what's good about being a girl, or to tell a boy what's good about being a boy. And it really has just it's a complete attack on the diversity that God has worked into this world through male and female, that we're, you know, male and female are equal, and yet we evidence different aspects of God's glorious character. He didn't create man to fully image God. He didn't create woman to fully image God, but aspects of his image in both, which are emphasized, you know, not completely one to the other, but as emphasis, and that we need one another. And I just think that this paints a glorious picture of, you know, of the human race. And it's sad that we've come to the place now where that's being attacked at the most fundamental level.
Mm. Well, and it's interesting to me that the research is coming out is identifying that for these young children, gender is absolutely part of how they understand their identity is through their gender. And when you begin to take that away, it's an incredibly dehumanizing
That's a great point.
Perspective that we're implementing onto our children and way that we're viewing children.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, our children make sense of the world through the, you might say, the disciplines of having the right fences in place. And so, for instance, this is what I'm such a big fan in my own family of discipline, is that, you know, when they have that discipline, those fences in place where they understand the world from these perspectives, then you can move out from there into freedom. Those fences actually aid freedom. And so, you know, when it comes to gender, that's true as well.
Absolutely.
My little boy, my 4-year-old Michael, he always wants to know, you know, is this person a boy? Is this person a girl? He makes sense of the world. That helps him organize his world by having those categories. And I think that we are just spreading confusion in our children when we start taking away those helpful categorizations.
My time in youth ministry, one of the things that I became completely convinced of is the need for structure.
Yeah.
Children need structure. And then when you have your own kids, you just see how clearly they thrive with structure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just a couple of days after the event that we went to that meeting, there was an article in our local paper. It said conservative activists rail against LGBT curriculum. They talked with Glenn Hansen, president of BC Teachers Federation. It says several attendees of the Cultural Guard event said they wanted to opt their kids out of the SOGI teachings, but Hansen says that would be impossible.
Yeah.
So how far are we down the line in this whole SOGI curriculum coming into our schools?
Well, you know, here's the good side before we get to the, you know, the bad. You know, the positive is that the SOGI curriculum aspects of for instance, the how teachers implement it is still very much up in the air, and teachers have freedom to implement pieces that they want, or in some cases, like not really much at all. And so, for instance, I've had some good discussions with teachers that will just say, and they're not necessarily Christians, but they're just saying, no, I'm not going to teach that. That's up to parents in the home. Mm. However, what, you know, from the very top, including, is it Hanlon? Is that right?
Hansman.
Hansman, there we go.
Yep.
People at the top of, you know, the educator food chain, whether it's the Teachers Federation, whether it's, you know, the government, they really are pushing this from the top down and training the teachers that are coming in. And so really, you know, things are being put in place from the top down, and it'll just be a matter of time before teachers will be in the place where they will have to do this. They'll have to be teaching these things. And yeah, you can't opt out. And the thing that people are saying, of course, is, you know, you can't opt out of it just in the same way that, you know, we're going to teach kids about racism and all these other, you know, isms and phobias and you know, you're not going to be able to opt out of that either. And one of my responses to that is to conflate the two is simply unacademic. It's not scientific to conflate the two in any way. You know, one of the things that people don't realize is just the level of desistance that adolescents have when it comes to gender dysphoria. You know, a very rough figure would be between 80 to 90% of gender dysphoric children and adolescents will desist after puberty. And so, you know, I mean, Steensma, I think it's 2011, he says this is the unequivocal finding. And, you know, researchers don't use the word unequivocal lightly. There's no answer to that. And it really is completely irresponsible. I mean, beyond that, it really is child abuse to be for schools to be pushing a dogma and teaching that's going to lead kids into sterilization, into lifelong medicalization, into cutting off healthy parts of their body, when 80 to 90% will persist if you just
nothing. Desist? You said persist.
Did I say persist? Yeah. Desist. Yeah, sorry.
I think this is a really important point, because we've heard pushback from us with regards to SOGI that this is an important thing for bullying and helping students. And I think it's important for us to just make clear, you know, we don't want kids to be bullied.
Absolutely.
We are absolutely against that.
Absolutely.
But what I don't think people appreciate is that there's a bullying taking place now on the opposite side.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're asking is what leads to healthy children, healthy society? One of the things that needs to take place then is in the schools, how can we implement things in such a way that, okay, if there is somebody that's questioning their gender, that they're obviously, we don't want them bullied.
Yeah.
But to implement this amongst everyone, would you agree that this is just a bullying on the opposite end?
Yeah, I would, yeah. I mean, I've experienced that personally, that when some of the information around my my campaign, the Woman Means Something campaign, which led, you know, against Bill C-16, led to me presenting to the legal committee for Senate.
Can we pause there just
sure.
for a minute? Because we have listeners from outside of Canada who may not be very familiar with Canadian politics.
Yeah.
Could you tell us just a little bit about Bill C-16, what that entails, and then move on to your testimony before the Senate?
Sure. Yeah. So Bill C-16 was the national legislation sponsored by, you know, by the Liberal government to put gender identity and gender expression into the Human Rights Code, as well as to put it in as an aggravating, you know, circumstance under the Criminal Code, which is something actually I fully support. And so it, you know, it's brought in under the auspices of, you know, here is another group that faces challenges and barriers, and so we need to recognize them in the Human Rights Code. What people are not willing, and in fact, a lot of the senators were not willing to really consider, is the detrimental effects it has, especially on women's rights. That was the perspective that I took. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that, for instance, women's sports now are really undermined and destroyed. I mean, there's reasons we have women's sports. There's biological fundamental differences between the male body and the female body.
And you know what's interesting, by the way, about that is that there's a transition that takes place. Like my son right now is 10.
Yeah.
And right now the girls are destroying the boys.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But that's going to change soon.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 2-3 years.
It goes both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, you can't deny those things. Recently, I think just came across the news either this morning or last night that an Australian footballer was just, and I think this is good. They made the right decision. They were just a transgender, so male to female transgender person was just told they could not compete, you know, in the women's league. That's good. I mean, like you said, changes happen to the male body. And even if there are, if there's hormone use and maybe some of that advantage is negated, you still have things like bone structure. You still have got size. You've still got height. You've still got tremendous advantages, you know, in some of these sports. So, I mean, that's one aspect. Another aspect that was exceptionally important to me was the area of privacy mm-hmm. and protections when it came to places of privacy, whether it's showers, change rooms, washrooms. I was able to sit on a panel with someone from Hilla Kerner, the Women's Center down in Vancouver, Rape Relief. It's ludicrous. It really is to put males, regardless of how they identify, in with women that have been, you know, that have been raped. When the vast majority, actually, of trans women or trans-identified males, most of them retain male genitalia.
This is one of those things that really boggles my mind, that the same people who are so concerned about rape culture, be it on campus or off university campuses, and especially after this whole debacle with Harvey Weinstein out of Hollywood recently, right? And there's all these hashtag campaigns going out and things like that. The same people that are concerned about rape culture in our society are the same ones that are pushing for this kind of gender-neutral bathroom access where for predators, all they need to do is they just say that they're women, and there's just no way for us to verify whether this person is truly transgender or not. And you're just opening up this very vulnerable place. That just boggles my mind.
The question that I always like to ask, and I've never heard a decent answer to it, is, you know, why do we have separate change rooms in the first place? Right? It's because of bodies. It's because bodies are different. And of course, that those different bodies are connected, if not absolutely, significantly with sexuality. Women deserve the right of privacy. And it's interesting, actually, as I reviewed some of the cases that have taken place around issues of privacy, at least in Canada, I don't think there's ever been a ruling yet that has overturned a woman's right to privacy, you might say, kind of against the opposite sex. And yet that essentially was struck down through Bill C-16. Of course, you know, we'll see how that plays out in the law courts.
So if I go to the swimming pool this afternoon and I tell them there, hey, I identify as a woman, am I allowed to walk right into the women's changing room?
So the interesting thing is that BC has a similar gender identity and expression code. However, in the BC code, there is a provision for privacy rights around this that it would seem that a facility could appeal to if they didn't want to go along with the kind of the general tenor of these legislation, whether it's national, whether it's provincial, of yes, you're allowed to go where you want based on your own expression. So this essentially all the legal stuff is in place.
So really, we're talking a matter of time.
Exactly.
And that's one of the things I think is quite interesting about all this, is it's really just a matter of time until people begin to just withdraw from public services entirely.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, because it's not just Christians that are in an uproar about this. Mm. I mean, you've got Muslims and Sikhs that have, you know, a really strong idea of modesty in their culture. Mm. You know, you've got, I actually have a number of allies who are radical feminists and or lesbians, and they're saying this is absurd what's going on. You know, a lot of people don't realize that what is commonly portrayed as kind of the LGBT community, it's not a monolith where everybody believes the same.
You did mention, I remember from the presentation that you gave us a few weeks ago, that a lot of the LGB people are rather upset about the fact that transgender people are kind of grouped into the same category.
Yeah.
And they see transgenderism as sort of this ultimate conversion therapy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the studies show, and again, the findings have been replicated lots and lots of times, where somewhere between the majority and the vast majority of adolescents that desist from gender dysphoria will have same-sex attraction. So people are looking at that, and it just seems to be a very clear inference then that essentially what we're doing is people that have same-sex attraction, which I regard that as something very different than somebody engaging in same-sex behavior. Mm-hmm. Somebody who has same-sex attraction, they're being converted. They're being, you know, straightened, if you will, through medical intervention and sterilization. I mean, it's just it really is a terrible thing, and I do wish that more LGB people would come on board and realize that this is precisely what the literature is saying. You know, there's no way around it, and there's even some preliminary reports. I have a friend that's done some work on this. There's preliminary evidence, in fact, that the number of gays and lesbians are going down. And perhaps because, you know, adolescents are being transitioned. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
One of the things that's going through my mind, and I bet a lot of our listeners are thinking about, and I just want to throw this out there because I know we have a lot of U.S. listeners and people from all over the world, actually, that are thinking, oh, man, that's just a Canada thing. Man, it's crazy in Canada or crazy in Sweden. No. It's going to get crazy where you are too, because I remember it wasn't that long ago we used to point at Ontario and go, wow, I can't believe what's going on in Ontario.
Yeah.
And then boom, it's here.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen where you are as well. And so I want to throw two thoughts your way.
Yeah.
One is, okay, where people are at, what can they do? You know, maybe this hasn't come to their community yet. What can they proactively do? And then for somebody like us, where we're in the middle of this, I mean, what can people here in British Columbia do? I mean, can this even be changed? What would it require to undo this?
Yeah, so those are great questions, Andy. I think that, generally speaking, so you asked me first about people wherever they're at. I think that our culture in general, maybe I'm speaking more about as a Canadian, but thinking about Christians, I think we have a real courage problem. I think that, you know, one of the passages that the Lord's really used to speak to me has been in Revelation, and I believe it's chapter 20. There's this, you know, this long list of people that are going to be thrown into the lake of fire, and includes people that are sexually immoral, people who are liars, people who are sorcerers. But at the beginning of that list, the first thing listed are those who are cowards.
Wow.
I don't know of any other way of reading that passage than that it says that if you're a coward, you're not getting into the kingdom. I mean, the scripture's saying, you know, too, that if we deny the Lord Jesus Christ, he'll deny us. We need to stand up for what we believe. We need to be willing to speak it, not only to our neighbors, but to places of power. To be honest, I think we need a revival of courage in the Church of Christ.
Isn't that the irony, by the way, that it's the majority that are against this?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the minority that are pushing it.
Yeah, and whether it's the idiom the squeaky wheel gets the grease, or maybe you put it in a little bit more favorable way, but it's people that feel strongly and have the convictions that are willing to fight with them that get things done in this world, in this society. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to me that why isn't the Christians that have those deep convictions that are willing to fight for what they believe and get things done. As a generalization, I mean, speaking more to BC and what needs to happen here, right now, Carrie Simpson is somebody that people ought to keep their eyes on. She's doing amazing work, and I'm involved with her group called Culture Guard. That's more of the culture side of things. Parents Unite Canada is the group that's being raised up in connection with Culture Guard. That's really, and it's not a Christian group. It is a group that defends parental rights against sex activism in the schools. You know, it's a group that needs connections. There's a lot of rallies that are beginning to take place, and this movement needs support. You know, when the next rallies come up, you know, we're saying, hey, listen, bring five people out to a rally. Go and take some of the resources that Parents Unite Canada has. Go and talk to your teacher. Go to talk to your school district board. go talk to your local politician. We need to be involved politically as Christians.
Speaking of which, there was this one question that's been nagging at me. Same thing for Terry as well, because he and I were both at the meeting a few weeks ago on the Suji curriculum, and we actually had a chance to listen, hear from you and Carrie Simpson as well. But I just wanted an honest opinion from you, because when we were sitting there, your presentation, we were just riveted. We were fascinated by your presentation. But then when the next presenter came up, we found that some of her rhetoric, the jokes, were very inappropriate. I personally felt that she was outright mocking some people that are in the LGBTQ community. So my question was, for somebody like you who's so articulate and well-spoken, I think you really embody this, what Apostle Peter has required of us when we are giving an answer to those around us, right? With gentleness and respect. I personally didn't see that from the other presenter. I wonder why it is that you are working.
And it was those instances or those phrases that she uses that came out in that article that I referred to at the beginning.
Yeah.
They really honed in on those.
Sure. Yeah, so for myself, let me just start with a couple basic presuppositions. The first one is this, that my willingness to work together with people is, I guess I have a really, how to put this, I'm willing to work together with all sorts of people on all sorts of things, because I think that that's how politics works. So that's my basic presupposition. Mm. I'm going to answer the question more specifically, but for instance, I work together with gays and lesbians against the trans narrative that's going on in the mainstream media. Probably more for them, certainly not for me, but for them, I understand that they feel that that's a very awkward kind of alliance. You know, I don't support gay marriage, right? I mean, as one example. To be more particular, I do believe that same-sex behavior is against God's plan and desire, right? So, I mean, this is an awkward alliance, right? But I believe that's what politics is about, mm-hmm. right? So I'm willing to work with all sorts of people. Now, more specifically about the people that I work with at Culture Guard, they are good people that love LGBT people. Carrie Simpson does have more of a, she has a very direct approach. And what I have found is that I think humankind, we tend more just naturally towards either truth or grace, and it's really hard to hit that balance just precisely on. Mm-hmm. And that I have found that there's a lot of people that will say, okay, we got to do this with grace, and they never have the courage to actually stand up and say something or even to fight, mm-hmm. To fight the battles that need to be fought. You look at somebody in history like Martin Luther. I don't know if you know some of the things that he said, but I mean, some of the things he said, and I respect Martin Luther tremendously, he's one of my heroes, but you know, if one of my pastors used the kind of language he did, I have a hard time with him being my pastor.
Right.
So my point is this, that I respect Carrie Simpson tremendously for the work she's doing. I think that at times that some of the things she says are taken out of context. I do think that that there are times she says things that are, you know, not the way I would say them or not the way I would like them to be said. But I'm happy to work with her. I do believe she loves LGBT people. I believe that she almost always, and I actually talked to her about this after the last meeting, she almost always makes a distinction between sex activists and LGBT people in general. And she did do that at the meeting.
I remember that.
Yeah. But I do think that, you know, unless you regularly do that, people will hone in on the things you say and point to them and say, hey, listen, here are people that clearly, you know, hate or you know, are ridiculing others. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's certainly not my approach. And from what I know of Carrie, that's not her. That's not her either.
Okay. Well, that's actually really good to hear from you on that, because that, man, that plagued me for the last few weeks.
That night of the meeting, you gave us a lot of research that night, and a lot of it wasn't Christian.
No, hardly any of it was.
Right? You even said, don't trust me.
Yeah, that's right.
Go do it for yourself.
Yeah, so just a word about that I maybe I'll connect this with something that's happened this last week. I'm not sure if you're aware, but earlier on this week, a trans-identified male, Lisa Salazar, wrote up an op-ed in the Vancouver Sun about me. and the presentation that I'd given in Langley, which the presentation is on YouTube. It's on the internet, so anybody can go and see it and check out the references for themselves. And Lisa went and she connected with some of the researchers that I had cited and said, "Hey, listen, does this represent your research?" And some of them came back and said, "Well, because you know he said things and not other things, then he ripped it out of context," which is categorically untrue. One of the things that I always, it's part of my approach, and I wrote this in my answer to Vancouver Sun. I don't know whether they're going to print it. It is available. My answer is available at Culture Guard.
We can also put that on a show notes.
Okay, yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, is that whenever somebody does, like myself, does research, you essentially have, broadly speaking, you have two approaches. You can either quote from those that not only agree, that not only are you quoting their data, but you're also quoting their conclusions. In other words, you can quote from people that generally agree with where you're going with your presentation. Or you can take the data that people do not, you know, their conclusions are coming out somewhere else, but you're looking at their data and you're doing the work of coming to your own conclusions based on the data. And, you know, when you use the first approach, you open yourself up to claims of bias, right? Oh, you're only using certain sources, right? I hate mm-hmm. that. So what I would rather do is I would rather go to the sources where I may disagree significantly with their conclusions, but I'm going to look at your data and I'm going to say, well, this is clearly what you're showing. And that opens up somebody like me to claims of misrepresentation. However, not a single one has given an evidence of where and how I've misrepresented them, right? The whole point just comes down to the fact that I've arrived at different conclusions based on the data than you have, which, you know, conclusions I believe are, you know, just, you can't possibly come to different conclusions. So let me give you one example, if I can. I was in email correspondence with a very prominent sex researcher, Dr. Rich Savin-Williams, who found in 2007 in a very, very good longitudinal survey, research done through the Ad Health information, which is, you know, generally available to a lot of different researchers, found that 83% of same-sex behaved adolescents, whether they were same-sex behaved or both sex behaved, but they're involved in same-sex sexual behavior, they became completely heterosexually behaved within 6 years. Okay, 83%. So you're talking about the vast majority. And this just really shows that same-sex attraction is not immutable, which is kind of the prevailing narrative right now, is that same-sex attraction is immutable. And it just simply is not, and especially is not, in adolescence. So I got in conversation over email with Dr. Rich Savin-Williams, and you know, it was fascinating to see that I would repeatedly ask him questions about his research, and he would repeatedly refuse to answer them. You know, and I'm putting that together with the fact that, especially in adolescence, same-sex attracted kids are in a very high-risk category when it comes to things like suicidality or teen pregnancy, all sorts of things. And everybody would recognize that, you know, but I'm arguing, essentially, listen, you need to have policies that are built on true data, which is that, you know, the vast majority of these kids will not be in this category within 6 years. And the fascinating thing is that Rich Savin-Williams, essentially, the main thing that he pointed to as far as how I quote unquote misrepresented him is that he has come to essentially disagree with his initial findings. And I believe completely for political reasons. The interesting thing for me is that since then, his findings are now being replicated by so many others. So it's bizarre. His findings are being replicated. He was one of the first ones that found this. And yet, you know, he's not willing to hold to it for political reasons. I mean, everybody else now is finding the same thing, that, you know, sexual orientation is incredibly fluid. It's not remotely immutable. And so just an example of how this gets, you know, misrepresented in the media.
There was something that I wanted to ask you about, because I think a lot of LGBTQ advocates are coming at this from the perspective of compassion, right?
That, yeah, absolutely.
You know, there are. So, I mean, I don't want to demonize anybody. I want to assume good intention on all sides. And so I understand these advocates come from the perspective of compassion and they say, look, there's this high suicidality rate among transgender adolescents, or, you know, adolescents who are same-sex behaved and all of that stuff. So if we don't alleviate that through things like the SOGI curriculum, or, you know, whether it's sex reassignment surgeries and things like that, that is inhuman, is the objection.
Yeah.
But it sounded like from your research, this is actually not helping.
Yeah. So first of all, a word of caution, and that is that the studies do show that in some cases that supports, just generally speaking, supports alleviate suicidality at some levels. So, you know, roughly I'm characterizing that from studies I've seen in maybe the 20 to 30% level. Okay. And I just think that that's normal human behavior, right? That when you, you know, when you're supported, generally speaking.
Like a school counselor or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, one study I saw, and I'm not necessarily saying this is completely representative, but it was a good study, found that, for instance, GSAs, so Gay Straight Alliances in schools, did not help people as much as, you know, one-on-one counseling. And so just as one example that, you know, support helps. Of course support helps, but what are we supporting people in doing? Like, what does that support look like? I'll get to your question in a second.
Yeah.
One study I'd love to see. I'd love to see somebody do a study on, you know, same-sex attracted adolescents that are involved in sports versus not involved in sports, and see whether that something that's completely unrelated to sexual orientation, identity, or behavior can show some of the same general support and alleviation of suicidality, you know, without being in any way connected with their, you know, their sexuality. I think it probably would. I think it probably would. Mm-hmm. Anyways, to get to your question, you know, it's interesting that in places like the Netherlands and San Francisco, that rates of suicidality, this is one example of the kind of risks that same-sex adolescents are facing. They haven't gone down. They haven't gone down, even though they are, you know, ahead of us probably by, you know, somewhere between 15 to 20 years, you know, as far as the normalization of, you know, of same-sex, you know, identity and maybe to a lesser degree, transgender, you know, gender identity. So one very interesting study done by Sanjay Agarwal, I think the subtitle is Dutch Paradox, where in the introduction he says, this is a well-recognized phenomenon where in places that, you know, we've done all the progressive things that we were supposed to do, that we haven't seen, you know, the lessening of suicidality, you know, amongst gay men. And I think that was his focus in that particular study. And so, you know, the question is that I would ask is, well, if we've done everything that, you know, all of the LGBT advocates asked us to do, whether it's the normalization of, you know, gay marriage or gay straight alliances in schools or the kind of SOGI policies, we've done all that, and that hasn't moved the needle. It hasn't moved the needle. Then what hope do we have that some of the now the much more subtle things that they're trying are going to move the needle? I just think it's a failed enterprise. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a complete misunderstanding of what's going on here.
Yeah.
One of the things then I think that is something a lot of people are thinking about, and I think that as a Christian, we've got to give thought to, and that is, do we remove our children, particularly with regards to SOGI, do we remove our children from the school system, you know, particularly an aggressive evangelistic school system, and then just pretend like this will all go away or just doesn't affect you personally? Or are we invested in this issue? And one of the things that's going through my mind is it's so easy just to withdraw from culture. But I get particularly concerned with this issue because I'm concerned for the students that are getting swept into what's happening in our culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that potentially as parents that aren't engaged and just don't care and don't realize the irreparable damage that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and I'm concerned about the same thing. I have a tremendous love for LGBT people. It's something the Lord's put on my heart, and you know, depending on what you see of me in the media, you might not necessarily realize that as I'm, you know, fighting SOGI curriculum in the schools, but I love my gay friends, and you know, I love adolescents that are struggling with whether it's gender identity, whether it's same-sex attraction. I want to protect them too. you know? I want to protect the freedoms that, you know, for instance, my fellow Canadians that are, you know, Muslim and Sikh and, you know, the Syrian refugees coming in. I want to protect them too. I want to protect the Christian families that don't have the money to pull their kids out and put them in a private school. I want to protect the parents that, you know, because of maybe the family situation aren't going to be able to homeschool. So what I would say is, you know, maybe parents do need to be thinking about taking their kids out of the public school, but not before speaking up and saying something. Mm-hmm. Because here's the thing, Andy, is that there's a lot of, in Christian circles, there's a lot of talk about justice ministry. And I love it because Lord wants us to do righteousness. But guess what? Some righteousness will not get the kudos of the world. Some of the righteousness, some of the justice that we need to do as Christians will get you hated by the world. And that's the justice that God has called us to do. And so, you know, I think that we need to stand up, we need to speak and not just disengage.
Here's a really interesting example of this. One of the other aspects in the curriculum, there's a number of things that are being rolled out in our curriculum besides SOGI. One of them is that in high schools, one of the curriculums that's coming out, it's now kind of out, it's beta, but it's going to be next year for sure rolled out, is discussions on genocide. And basically, I've looked at the curriculum, and basically what it is just a listing off in a historical study of genocide after genocide. One of the key components that's missing to it, and this is just critical to the discussion in general, is that when you look at genocide, what you're talking about, one of the main aspects of it, according to the UN, is dehumanization. And this is one of the key aspects of what it means in genocide. But what's completely lacking in the curriculum is, what is dehumanized? You know, how do you humanize? What actually is a human being?
Yeah, fantastic.
You know, and this is part of the discussion that's going to have to start taking place as we're looking at, well, what does it actually mean to be a human being? And what does it mean to be made in the image of God? What does it mean to be made male and female?
Yeah, exactly.
And that we're going to need to be able to construct a positive understanding of what a human being is, and particularly be able to do that as Christians in a culture that's wrestling with our humanity in a number of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, it really does come down to these presuppositions, and I love that tactic. You know, an interesting thing that occurs to me is that S.J. Mason, I'm not sure if you know him, he's out east, but he's done some excellent work on some of the things that have taken place in Ontario with the bills that they have rolled out in regards to, hopefully I can characterize it the right way, but that parents, and I think it's especially affecting parents of children that are kind of in the system as far as, you know, adoptive parents or foster parents, that you have to be willing and ready to support your child if they come out as, you know, gay or transgender. And what he has said, S.J. Mason has a Mohawk background. And what he is saying is that this is the residential school thing all over again. That now we have, you know, we've got a government that is saying to its people, we know what's best for you, and we are going to take away your children because we know what's best. I think it's a post-colonial ideology that we're wrestling with.
And here's Terry sitting there rigorously nodding his head.
That was one of my thoughts in the last week, too, was
okay,
this
yeah.
whole coming back to this residential school thing, because I've been doing a little bit of more study about it and stuff. But yeah.
Tell me about your mom, man.
Yeah, my mom was in residential schools for 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so I've been able to talk with her more so in the last little while about her experiences, but she's always been kind of mum about them while I was growing up.
What's the interesting parallels there, particularly this idea, right, where, oh, we're going to help modernize the, you know, these savages or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Completely.
Help them so they'll fit into society correctly and have the right ideas, and you know they won't have these barbaric or these outdated ideas or worldview.
Hey, absolutely, that is precisely what's happening, and it's colonialism all over again.
And
people don't see it. I'm thankful for people like S.J. Mason from that background that can speak up and say something.
And you actually said something to us at the very beginning, and that is that the school system has moved from educating our children to things like math and history to morals, and that now there is a moral agenda that is being driven and at a progressive rate in our society that we're going to have to be aware of. And it's interesting, in the past, you could opt out of these things, even as Christian schools.
Yeah, yeah.
But as these things have come out, even like Soji, that you can't opt out of that, even as a Christian school.
Yeah.
These are implemented on everybody.
Yeah, and you know, for the Christian schools, I think people need to hear that too, you know, Andy, that these things they will come. It'll lag a little bit. It might lag by 2-3 years, maybe. But there's no safe haven from this ideology. I do think, and I'm speaking as a pastor now, but I do think we face a Bonhoeffer moment here. I do. I think this is the moment where either we stand up and say something because the devil is, you know, attacking the most fundamental aspect of how God has created us in his image as male and female, or we go quietly into the good night along with the world. This is the moment that we need to stand up and speak.
Yeah. A lot of our listeners are probably wondering, because we mentioned a lot of these studies and things like that, where can they get their hands on some of these studies? Do you have something that you can impart to our listeners, or?
Yeah, so currently a lot of my research, but on, especially on transgender-related issues and the protection of women, that's all at my website, womanmeanssomething.com. It was interesting. We kind of put it up in haste, just we didn't know how long the fight was going to be before they finally voted on Bill C-16. As the Lord would have it, it actually went through the Senate much slower than what we first expected. I think that was of God, and it was neat that it gave me an opportunity to speak to the Senate on these things. The website has not been updated really much since Bill C-16 passed. However, there's tremendous amounts of information there and research that I've done.
Okay, womanmeanssomething.com?
Yeah, womanmeanssomething.com.
All right.
The other place, though, is a lot of my more recent talks and research is up at cultureguard.com.
Okay. Time is against us. Again, we'll wrap up here. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. It was a pleasure finally to meet you in person. And we thank you for the work that you're doing. And we wish you every blessing from our Lord. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada. If you want more of the research and things like that we mentioned, make sure you go to our show notes. That is to say, go to our website, apologeticscanada.com, scroll down and you'll see our post there, and just click on that link and you'll be directed to the page where the podcast episode is actually nested, and you'll see a bunch of links there. You can click on those and access some of those research material that Paul mentioned today. We'll come back next week with more stuff to think about. Thank you for joining us. Ciao for now. We'll be right back.